Really excited to welcome Dr. Christian Payon to our podcast. Christian is a orthopedic trauma surgeon at Duke University, and he holds multiple leadership titles at the university, including Director of AI and IT Innovation in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery. He's a core faculty member at the Margolis Institute of Healthcare Policy, and he is the CEO and co-founder of Revel AI Health, which we'll obviously get into today. Christian and I both serve on the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons Digital Health Task Force, where I've gotten to know Christian, and I'm really excited to invite him on and to dive into all things AI and digital health when it comes to orthopedics. So, Christian, thank you again for joining us.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I'm a big fan.
Awesome. My first question is, tell me a little bit about your background in orthopedics as a traumatologist, how you got into or how'd you pick trauma, what got you in the field of orthopedics to begin with?
Yeah, it's funny. The way that I got into orthopedics was actually scrubbing into a liver transplant surgery in my first year of medical school and realizing that time in the operating room seemed to go faster than any other time because I was enjoying it so much. That was what got me off of the path from actually being interested in emergency medicine or internal medicine. Thank God I didn't go that route. And that prompted me to do a summer research fellowship program at the Hospital for Special Surgery, which further accelerated my interest in orthopedics. And actually, what ended up clinching it after having that seed planted in the idea of surgery was spending some time in Haiti and seeing that there was this huge void for orthopedic trauma care there. There was another life of mine that was centered on this idea of scaling global surgery and capacity building. And after that experience, I leaned into orthopedics. I did a research year between my third and fourth year of medical school at NYU with Dr. Kenneth Eagle. And I never turned away from trauma. I always wanted to do something where I could really be at the intersection of public health and musculoskeletal care. And it felt like for me, orthopedic trauma was really that field where I could do that. My interest evolved from abroad to here in the United States as I got more interested in health policy. Ended up doing my residency at NYU and then my fellowship at MGH Brigham, where I know you were for some time. And it was while I was at Harvard that I started to get really interested in this idea of leveraging technology to risk stratify patients, deliver care. And that was also where I met who ended up being my co-founder later, Hadi Javid, a machine learning engineer, and starting Revel AI Health.
Awesome. You made a kind of joke about emergency room. I will say probably the toughest rotation to do in medical school for me was emergency room, not because of the subject matter, just it's a tough environment.
Oh, it's
And
brutal.
I will say though, I look on my ER colleagues now, and they are the happiest, at least the ones I know, because they can do whatever they want. If they want to do three shifts a week and put them on the weekends or put them during the week, if they want to do a locum week, they can do that. Whereas me as a elective orthopedic surgeon, I can't just leave the practice and practice in Hawaii or in
Really?
the Alps. I've got to be here. Although trauma, I'm sure you guys can move a little bit, but I certainly cannot. So I have a lot of envy for my ER colleagues and even my traumatologist that you guys can just go anywhere you want to and it's fine. No one's gonna
Right.
miss you.
No,
They'll
they don't
just take
miss
care of
me.
trauma
No.
elsewhere. Now let's talk a little bit about your like you wear a lot of hats right now.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you're the CEO and co-founder of a digital health a company, that's going to be pretty front and center in a lot of what you do. It's going to be pretty consuming. But tell me about that evolution from going from saying, okay, I'm going to be clinically focused to now wearing all these hats. And how do you split your time? And it's, for us, it's not really a 40-hour work week. It's like a whatever hour work week.
No,
So
it's a
it's so
120-hour work week,
yeah.
right?
So where do you kind of split up your time, or at least try to split up your time?
Yeah, and I still have a tremendous clinical responsibility, and I still spend a lot of time clinically operating, and I have had my interest in entrepreneurship come with me to Duke when I started here. And I was fortunate to, I think, have a chairman and a department that understood that what I was doing with Revel AI Health was really impactful and would help me scale some of the impact that I wanted to make in the department. The split is tough. I still operate Tuesdays and Fridays. But the time that I do have dedicated to academics, I've been fortunate to have dovetail my interests in artificial intelligence and in the company. It's still like I'm sure it is for you, a lot of nights and weekends. But I have found a way to balance the two as best as you can balance a life as a clinician and a startup founder. What I think has been nice is so much of what I do at Duke is focused on care transformation, bringing technology into clinical workflows to improve care. And I do think that the lessons that I'm learning in my leadership at Duke, whether it's reducing length of stay or trying to figure out what the new opportunities are in longitudinal bundles, I think that those lessons have helped bolster my understanding of digital health and where a technology like Revel AI could make a difference for patients and for clinicians.
Yeah, and you know, you made a joke about the OR time being the time that goes by the fastest when you're in the OR. Like, I'm pretty bad with checking my phone, and the only time you'll get me to not check my phone is if I'm scrubbed in. Like, even sleeping, yeah, I'll roll over and check it. But in the OR, I am fully detached,
fully focused. So. Yeah. And it is, you know, it's funny, like, it's a lot of code switching, right? Because you're doing these cases and your focus is obviously 100% on the patient. And I do think the nice thing about what you and I do is that the operating room almost feels like it's this moment of flow and zen and focus away from all the things that are pulling your attention, whether it's your clinical responsibilities and quality improvement responsibilities, or, you know, putting out fires for the startup, or, you know, speaking to potential customers or partners for a new contract.
It is a wild transformation to go from 1 minute scrubbing case and focusing on one person to then, you know, a little bit later, not the next minute, but a little bit later saying, okay, shifting gear towards like selling to a health plan or selling to a customer or building or fixing something that's broken. It is hard to compartmentalize that sometimes, but I think that what makes it a little easier, at least, and you can tell me what you think, is if I started our company in my first couple of years in practice, it would have been very challenging. Because my learning curve when I first started practice was doing surgery. And even, you know, like routine stuff, ACLs, rotator cuffs, you're still learning. You're still improvising. You're still learning your technique. Now, several years in, I just started my 10th year in practice. As I started doing more administrative stuff at the health system and the startup stuff, I started coning down my practice to things that were really, really routine that I have done over and over again. And so you don't have that learning curve. Sure, you still don't take anything for granted, but you don't have that learning curve of, okay, how do I do an ACL? Because I've done hundreds at this point. You have opened up a little bit of bandwidth to start actually using on other things to build. I don't know how it is in trauma. Trauma's pretty vast, absolutely. But I was doing everything. We were doing operating on all kinds of stuff when I first started.
And you know, what has happened for me is I think that my focus surgically and clinically has narrowed. Yeah, I still do complex cases, but it's really around the humerus and the hip. It's this intersection between arthroplasty for fracture-related post-traumatic arthritis or fractures. And really, like, that's where I live, is like the proximal humerus, the humerus, and then the hip. And I'll do all of the principle-based additional trauma. But my partner, Malcolm, has really launched into the malunion, non-union complex reconstruction, pelvis acetabulum. And I do think that you have to have like this lane that you carve out. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to be excellent at all of it.
Yeah, for me, it was paring back, you know, shoulder replacements, although we had, brought a number of faculty that were doing it, so it was pretty easy, and hip preservation. So now I'm really coned in, and so it allows me to really keep being excellent and get even more focused. So I'm with you completely. Tell me about the work that you're doing at the Markola Center. That obviously might be a little more of an extension from your volunteer work, but or at least a logical jump, but tell me what you're doing there at Markola's.
Yeah, a lot of my focus at Margolis has still been around actually the value-based payment side. I'm really interested in trying to understand how, in particular, social drivers of health could be impacting outcomes for patients who are in these bundles. A lot of the focus that we've had recently has been both on the delivery of care for hip fracture patients to understand whether some of these socio-demographic factors can influence their postoperative course and the cost of care that they receive. And we've also started to think about what are some of the upstream models of care that we could maybe apply within the fracture care space. So, you know, one great example there is bone health. We have a bone health clinic that we've implemented since I started. And we have seen that in the patients that we shuttle to that clinic as part of this quality improvement work, a lot of them have social drivers of health impacting them. And those social drivers actually drive a lot of the postoperative spend and the likelihood that they're going to get treated for osteoporosis. And so now what we're doing at Margolis is trying to understand, okay, you know, there's these new mandatory bundles coming out. What role does care navigation for those patients in the hip fracture bundle, what role does it play in order to contain costs, improve outcomes, and can we eventually start advocating for policy that incentivizes care navigation for those patients and also the more longitudinal prevention of osteoporotic fractures?
I think one of the big tragedies, and most people, when they think of value-based care, they don't think of hip fractures unless you've done a bundle like BPCI and you've, you know, had to understand what, you know, what determines success in a hip fracture bundle. Because most people think of value-based care, they think of total joint replacement, right?
Totally.
But that's really, but episodic bundles are really fee for service, right? You're doing a surgery, and if you don't have the right indication, you just pay for surgery. What bothers me about the hip fracture bundle work that has gone on from the government level is that you have no opportunity to learn, right? You start this bundle, and if you lose your shirt because you don't know what you don't know, like, you don't have a chance to actually say, okay, there's a 1 year grace period. Sometimes they are, but a lot of times you don't. And so two things happen. One, you quit early, right? Because you say, well, it takes years to change this. And then two, this spiral down, like the death spiral of pricing, means you eventually quit. And Rothman had a big, you know, piece on it where they actually left the bundles because they got so good at them that they couldn't make margin anymore because they kept getting priced down. And I think we're never going to get adoption until we fix that mindset.
Paradigm. I agree. Yeah. Yeah. And I think in hip fracture, the problem is that, to your point, the learning curve is steep. And especially with this new transforming episode accountability model, we've got 747 hospitals that for the first time are going to have to participate in managed care. And it's pretty unforgiving. You know, in the second year, you're subject to downside risk. I think my other constructive criticism of those bundles is they're kind of short-sighted. And maybe that's good from the perspective of control. You're only responsible for the 30 days post-operative, so maybe some of these medical comorbidities are not going to spill over into what you're responsible for. But I think we end up losing sight for this group of patients in particular on secondary fracture prevention. I would really love to see shifts into value-based care models, even if it's just us dipping our toes in with a CPT code, kind of like the way transitional care management does for patients being discharged from the hospital for osteoporosis treatment in these hip fracture patients.
And you know, the other challenge around metabolic bone health in general is that the AOA, the American Orthopedic Association, has done this initiative On the Bone. And I don't know if you guys are following On the Bone or part of On the Bone, but they've done this beautiful job about saying, okay, this is how you do fracture prevention. But guess what? And I remember reading the slide is that anybody doing metabolic bone health or type of bone health prevention program is expected to lose money.
Yeah. Right?
And so you're doing it as a service. And there's a presentation that the Own the Bone has is that this is how you break even. Well, it's very hard. And this is a challenge of our reimbursement system and doing multidisciplinary care. Like, we're never going to get adoption at scale at fragility fracture prevention if it's a money loser for the health system, right?
Totally.
Or the hospitals. So I don't know what's going to have to change for that to get fixed, but that's just a simple reimbursement issue.
Yes. And this is something that I'm really interested in and passionate about. I mean, had to make the business case for this bone health clinic at Duke. And we hired a nurse practitioner. We've got resources dedicated to this. And when you make the business case, it's really hard because there is no dedicated CPT code for preventing fractures in these patients. You know, you're just not going to drive new surgical volume per se with this bone health clinic, and the incentives aren't really aligned to help. But it's a huge problem, right? We've got over 300,000 hip fractures a year. We've got an aging patient population. Osteoporosis is plaguing the nation, and it is a cost driver for patients and for health plans, but it's sort of this invisible threat. And unfortunately, I agree, the incentives just have not aligned to make it so that health systems want to adopt bone health programs. I'm hoping that will shift over time, but we need something to move the needle there. So that's part of the work we're doing for sure at Duke.
If you are chomping at the bit to make an impact on value-based specialty care, whether through technology, care delivery, value-based programming, then I encourage you and I invite you to join our community on value-based specialty care education. Click the link below, sign up for the newsletter, send us a message, and we'll connect.
Yeah, and you know, and with the integrated delivery networks and when you have the kind of fully risk
population, then you'll see that shift. But
Totally.
you're right, the reimbursement system doesn't make sense for it. And it's kind of like when we say, woe is us, we don't have enough primary care doctors, we can't incentivize them to go into primary care. It's like, well, just change the reimbursement. Like, you'll fix it. It's really
It's
straightforward. You
easy.
pay more, it's not hard. But I guess that's not an option for whatever reason, although we can do it for anything else. It's starting, but it's not even, And tell me then about the role on the AI and IT. Not every department has a leader that's devoted to technology and innovation adoption. Tell me how you know, what does that consist of, and what's your kind of mandate from the department? Like, why are they investing in this role, and what do you hope to help with?
I really applaud Duke and the and my chairman, Ben Allman, for having the foresight to dedicate resources and leadership to this area. I think that we really recognized, maybe even before the ChatGPT moment, but especially after, the way that care gets delivery is going to change, right? And it's changing before our eyes. You and I both, in our respective roles at our companies, are leveraging artificial intelligence in all kinds of ways to make care more efficient. And in the department, we said we want to lead when it comes to artificial intelligence, the implementation of artificial intelligence, our staff members being facile with these tools, specifically to drive outcomes and to contain costs. So my mandate is to, one, increase visibility for the department, for the work they're already doing around building imaging models, around leveraging machine learning in order to better risk stratify patients, and also to improve the adoption of tools that use AI specifically for care transformation purposes. And, you know, I'll give one example. We have implemented an ambient scribe in at our health system, and we're tracking the utilization, the activation of our department for that tool, but we're also trying to understand how we can use that technology in other areas besides just documentation. Can we use ambient technology to now start to drive some of the quality reporting that we have to do? Are we going to be able to innovate and implement after-hours AI agents that can answer the calls that come from patients so that they get answers to their questions more quickly and to triage some of those queries? And, you know, my mandate over the next year is to implement, is to adopt, implement, but also measure impact. So I'm really excited about the role. It is definitely interesting because a role like this hasn't existed before here. And I think all over the country, we have chief AI officers or chief medical information officers or innovation vice chairs who now are having AI sort of tucked in to their role. And for me, it's about crafting a strategy for these tools that moves the needle on care. You know, I'm less interested in doing something cool and with the technology and more about doing something impactful with it and helping my department members get access to resources and partner with entities, companies, and researchers who can drive the needle forward on patient care using technology to do so.
Within AI, you mentioned this, like the ambient listening for documentation. Clearly, scribes are probably the first use case that's had that adoption. Where are you guys in scribe use from an orthopedic perspective and system perspective at large at the health system?
We've adopted an ambient scribe. We use Abridge at Duke, and it's been fantastic. I do think that there's an interesting dynamic now. You probably have seen that Epic is launching their own ambient scribe, but I will say that they've been a good partner, and Abridge has really changed the way that I write clinical notes. And I think that for us, we one wanted to implement this technology and see how it's utilized. Probably a little over half of our orthopedic surgeons are relying on an ambient scribe to help write their notes. And I think that what's interesting is now they're starting to roll out tools to help with the bane of all of our existence, prior authorization. And I'm really excited to see how, at the point of care, we can surface the diagnoses that honestly help us close care gaps, but then also can streamline efficiency and get patients the care that they deserve without the friction of some of these appeals and the prior authorization process impeding that care.
Yeah, prior auth and UM is kind of a whole different thing, where I think I wrote about it on LinkedIn this week, right? Like, it's most of it is just documentation, like saying, oh, we called them, we told them their BMI was 40, they need to lose weight, and okay, now we have the surgery approved. The other game that's being played, which this is an aside, is that in shoulder surgery, right, if I'm going to do a rotator cuff, I'm going to we've been forced to ask for permission to do a rotator cuff repair, a subacromial decompression, a bicep tenodesis, a distal clavicle excision, and an intra-articular debridement. Five codes. Yeah. I don't know what codes I'm going to do. If I get in, the biceps looks healthy, I'm not doing anything with it. If I don't have to do a decompression, I don't have to do anything with it. But we've been told we have to request every code because if we don't, the patient will be stuck with a bill afterwards. And now the UM companies are saying, well, you don't have a biceps pathology on MRI, so I'm going to deny the biceps part and I'm going to take credit for lowering cost of care. So it's a charade that drives me crazy that there should be no credit given for a partial denial because we don't know what we're going to do until we get in there, but we're forced to make that multiple code because you made us. I'd rather just say I'm going to do a scope and I'll fix what I need to fix, but that doesn't fly anymore. So it's a really bad game that the UM vendors are playing.
Yeah, it's a horrible problem. And you know, you just described it, I think, pretty clearly. This documentation process and paper chase is dictating clinical judgment. And ultimately, you know, it's causing a lot of, I think, harm for the patient. There's a degree of financial harm. There's, you know, I think for the patient, a lot of confusion and fear whenever they're undergoing these procedures and they get stuck with the bill later. It's really problematic. And, you know, we don't have a good solution, right? Payers are trying to protect their margins, and sometimes abrasion or friction to try to root out overutilization is what they do to contain costs. And one of their mechanisms for doing that is prior authorization. But I think that the pendulum has just swung too far. And, you know, now you're, you know, you're trying to justify five codes, but these codes are, they're going to be based on your clinical judgment intraoperatively. Yeah. And it's not something you should have to think about, but hopefully we'll see a paradigm shift over the next few years. I don't know.
And do you think that what is a common reason if you have an orthopedic surgeon colleague that's not using Describe? What do you think? Is it just the technology curve that they're maybe on the slower adopter laggard type in that, or is there something that's just problematic with Describe that doesn't fit their practice? What is that reason for not using it?
You know, I will say, and I think that we've seen a lot of the narrative, especially lately, around ambient scribe technology being a bit of a commodity. And I think that it's getting commoditized, but there are good scribes and bad scribes. And I do think that there are going to be ambient technologies that are better for orthopedic surgeons, ambient scribes that are better for nurses, better for dermatologists. And what I'm seeing is that when you have a general purpose ambient scribe, there's just some surgeons in particular who have relied on templated notes who don't find it that useful. I think that it's you know, interesting. We've got specialists who don't find documentation to be as painful. They're really more interested in their operative notes rather than their clinic notes because they've got the template down pat. They know what they're going to ask. It's always the same. And the scribe is just adding workflow burden rather than taking workflow burden away. I think the other piece of it is there is a technology curve. Some people are just skeptical. They're like, I gotta log into my, you know, my app in order to turn it on. I have to have the conversation with the patient. But I think that there is so much value from this process of continuous ambient extraction of information from the narrative discussion with patients and actually with other providers. And it can serve in the future, in my opinion, as the basis for continual contextualization of care, prioritization potentially of care gap closure. And you have to sort of adopt the front end of the journey if you're going to do that. So it is an interesting time. Some clinicians are not going to find utility in these scribes. Yeah. They've got a different workflow.
Well, two kind of little anecdotes on that. So when I first started using R Scribe, I had
a patient. Does Proterra Health have a scribe?
Well, this is actually through our practice. So through at Henry Ford. So when I first started using the scribe, I got a message in my inbox saying, Dr. Mackney, why did you call me a he? It was a woman. Because a scribe, you know, like you have to double check the work. That's when I learned. And the scribe said it was clearly listed as female in the chart in Epic, a fairly routine, like feminine name. And kept saying he, and I didn't catch it because I was like, oh, it's an AI thing. It's going to be good.
Yeah.
And I had, you know how painful it is to describe that on a
to a patient
message to a patient and say, sorry. It was, and so after that, you learn. And so I was like, oh, in every note, I go in now and say, okay, I'm here with Joe Schmo, 45-year-old male, date of birth, because I have to do that. And that is where the integration with Epic may change things, unless that's just a scribe is an issue. And
no,
the
I
second
think,
thing is, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. No, I do think that you bring up a really, really important point. The hallucinations, the need to check, that's real. And
why couldn't it see that it was a female in the chart? Like, it just the basic integration, right? It's just a discrete data field that couldn't pull over. Sorry, I interrupted, but that was a very sobering realization.
Moment.
And the second thing is, you know what's really difficult is you have a surgical conversation with the patient. I like that you brought up this contextualized frame of different scribes, because you have this surgical discussion. I have this whole talk when I talk about ACL, the risk, the benefits, the other side, the graft side, the whole thing. And I look at the scribe note and it said, you know, Mr. Schmo would like to go forward with ACL reconstruction and was told that, you know, could have a blood clot. And like, what about everything else I talked about? Like, all gone. Nothing was in there. And I was told, no, don't worry, the scribe will get smarter. And I kept saying the same thing. It didn't. So what do? I now have to go in and either I don't use a scribe for a surgical patient, or I've got to go and type, and I can't use my template. So now I'm in no man's land. So that's the second issue that I think if I'm like a joint surgeon, that's routine,
totally.
Like, hey, this is not going to work for me. I'm just going to fill in my smart notes.
Yeah. I mean, you bring up such an interesting point. And I really hope that some of the ambient scribe technology CEOs are listening. Yeah. There's a lot of opportunity, and there's still challenges to more widespread adoption. There is nuance here. And I think that there's change management. We've seen this certainly too with other technologies we've adopted as a department. But you know, for me on the company side as well, you have to kind of delineate what AI can do and what AI can't. And if you don't implement technology like this with clear guidelines, guardrails, and transparency around what is possible and what isn't, you're going to lose clinicians, you're going to lose patients, and it's going to hinder the adoption of these tools and ultimately, you know, backfire on the progress that we can make.
Yeah. And, you know, I would say that, like, I think overall, I've been very impressed with the tools, but I think that we have that opportunity. And, you know, the last thing, and tell me what you think about if it's going to be for like an AI scribe that's not Epic mediated, right? So I'm in the room with the patient. I say, I'm going to prescribe you an MRI to make sure there's no meniscus tear, and I'm going to prescribe you physical therapy. But I still have to go and then actually type in those orders, right? Like, or is it a matter of the scribe has to be an Epic, you know, function to actually start doing that next step? Because that's really what's missing, right? If I got to go and type anything in order, like besides just editing the note, or can these other scribes like Abridge or whoever, can they integrate to that level? Is that going to be possible or not?
It's possible. There's proprietary APIs, and you know, there are opportunities to do that. But understandably, incumbent HR systems are going to have the highest level of scrutiny for vendor partners that they allow to put an order in, even as in a draft state to a clinician. I do think this is where incumbent EHR scribes are going to have a tremendous opportunity and leverage over the outside vendors. They're going to be able to own that workflow. It is true that there's good scribes and bad scribes. There's definitely a lot of thought that goes into a good scribe, but it's easy to launch an okay scribe. And we did it at Revel AI. Honestly, we have an ambient scribe that took us a little bit over 6 weeks to go from,
wow,
you know,
that's so crazy.
yeah, you know, to go from like, hey, we think it would be a value add for our clients to, hey, click a button in the platform and you can ambiently document a phone call, an asynchronous touch point, your note, and we've got templates for you. So like the barrier to entry is low. They're still like cream of the crop. And I do think that Ambience, Healthcare, Abridge have done an excellent job, but you want the next step. I want the next step. And the person or the entity that owns that next step in the workflow is the EHR. So it's going to be interesting to see how startups like ours, and especially some of these, you know, these are great companies, but these point solution companies, it's going to be interesting to see how these point solutions take the next step, if you will, differentiate and start to own more of the clinical workflow and prove ROI. I mean, I think that it is still hard to prove ROI with a tool like an Ambient Scribe to at least the CFO. I see the value. I'm less burnt out. we're able to see how many notes are getting written, that utilization is clear. But that's why I think we're seeing movement into revenue cycle management, automating prior authorization, and then the next step in the workflow, it'll be interesting to see what incumbent electronic health records let the innovators and the vendors do with them.
I will say, though, like, and same to Duke, shout out to Henry Ford, like, the investment into trying this out right now, the cost, and I don't want to say anything proprietary, but the cost per physician or per provider per month to use these services is insane.
It's pretty high.
And what's mind-blowing to me is you have the VC community, and maybe I'm gonna be wrong on this, it'll be a hot take, you know, years from now if anyone cares and they say Eric was wrong, but like those costs are not sustainable. It's like plasma TVs in the late 90s,
yeah,
right? You have a 30-inch plasma TV cost $10,000. Well, guess where we're at right now? Vizio is one of the best brands and they were the disruptor, right? Like a long time ago. And so I think that what's mind-blowing to me, maybe I'm just not seeing this, right? But to me, it's lunacy that these valuations keep going higher and higher when their business model is not only on something that's commoditized, that's at a premium now, so it's going to go down as the competition goes up, but the Epic announcement, how what am I missing?
How will they justify these valuations? I would love to get together with some of the CEOs of these companies and the VCs to understand, because I do think the valuations are inflated right now. But what I will say is that I had the opportunity to meet with the Freed CEO last week at an event in California. He's a very thoughtful guy. I do think that these technology companies, especially ones with, you know, like Shiv Rao, a clinician at the helm for Abridge, I think and I hope that they are making the case that the scribe is just the distribution channel, if you will, and that they're going to do things that are impactful, that move the needle on care and that deliver ROI. But I agree with you. We're going to see a little bit of a different kind of race to the bottom on the pricing of these scribes.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of clients at Revel AI Health that they love their Athena Health embedded scribe, and like that launched really recently. It serves their purposes. So why would you pay even $90 a month for a different ambient scribe? It's going to be interesting to see
more.
The differentiation or more. It's way more at the enterprise level.
Yeah,
but I think the SMB, the small and medium business scribes are going to have a hard time. I'm rooting for them, but I think they're going to have a hard time.
Yeah. You know, and I think they'll be able to do those wraparound services as long as they're not blocked by the EMR.
Totally.
Right, like, yeah. like if I'm an Athena, maybe I'll block out the other scribes and not let them do the wraparound services. I mean, I don't know, whatever the architecture is, but anyway, we'll close a chapter on the scribes.
Yeah.
I will say though that I'm grateful to my health system for taking that plunge. I don't know how many health systems are doing it, how widespread it is, but we were early on it as a health system, and I think it creates a lot of excitement. It's not like the same, you know. Epic dominates everything, but for us, but like it's a lot of excitement. So kudos to our health system for doing those.
Absolutely.
Let's move to Revel AI.
I am
learning a little about it, but for everybody out there, what is it? How did it start?
Yeah.
And what is that elevator pitch that you want to show us?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we really as a company at Revel AI are working to be the AI layer of clinical care orchestration around the episode of care. And our go-to-market has really been focused, I would say, on two things: trying to close care gaps and improve access for patients through communication channels that are improved by AI, and then workflow tools and wraparound AI, specifically around quality reporting and episode of care management. So honestly, the way that we approach care organizations is we ask them to walk us through what it's like to have a patient call into their organization, right? And for a lot of systems, that's a landline, that's a 20 to 30% abandonment rate of the call, that's little to no context and documentation of the calls once they do get answered. And then I ask them, you know, if they are considering an AI solution to help answer the calls, how they're planning to use that modality of communication to inform their care pathways. You know, we know that there's a huge improvement to be made for patients through high-touch, asynchronous care coordination. This ability to educate patients once they leave the four walls of the hospital on their care and maintain contact with them, especially if they're patients that are higher risk, that's invaluable, but it's operationally challenging, right? The way that we do it right now is we deploy care navigators, we've got joint classes, postoperatively, maybe someone's trying to call patients. Revel AI is deploying AI agents to be that frontline digital door entry to the care organization and really configuring its touch points for the patient and the documentation automation for the clinician around value-based care workflows. And that's generally for total joint replacement, hip fracture care to help automate some of these touch points for educating patients around bone health, but also nudging care navigators and clinicians in order to stay on top of the patients who are higher risk. So it's been a really great journey. We closed our seed round in April. We're deployed at almost a dozen care organizations now. And I think what's really exciting for me is pairing some of the clinical care with the social care. I think that there is this real difference that you can make in care if you understand your patient's clinical risk factors and social drivers of health. And what we've been doing is, yes, we're answering the call for your practice. We're deploying an ambient scribe so that you can automate your documentation. But then we're taking the next step and we're navigating patients to resources through our partner FindHelp, whether that's food insecurity or transportation access. And we're trying to loop all of that back to the quality reporting, patient report outcome measure collection, and ultimately helping health systems move the needle on the things that we know that they're mandated to do, whether it's the new transforming episode accountability model measures, patient report outcome measures, or more.
What I like about what you're saying is that it is different than what everyone else is doing. And now you know the field better than I do. You know your niche better than I do. But at least from what I'm hearing and what I've read about you guys, it's not like, hey, we're going to help with things I just mentioned, like order entry, right? Like, yeah. I mean, yes, that's great to do.
Great.
I want it, clearly, but that will get solved. And it's going to be solved soon, either the Epic version or anyone else. But I think that we struggle with all these kind of manual processes. You look at it, and I don't know if you guys are in this space, but like, look at a typical call center. Right.
Yes.
We have not been able to figure out appropriateness of routing. And no matter how hard we try, it is really hard to do. It's a transient workforce. So you have to train and you're trying to train them on indications and routing. Are you guys looking at that as well? Or
100%. So we've embedded the Schmidt-Thompson guidelines. Every call that comes in gets graded with an acuity level. We tag every category of call. And we really think that that's the wedge for the value that we bring to a lot of care organizations. But we really say, hey, like that is the front door. We're trying to guide patients to close those care gaps once they leave your office and help your care navigators do outreach. We'd love to, we'd love to partner with Proterra Health. We think what you guys are doing is fantastic. We want to enable companies like yours that are really honed in on value-based care and that are delivering services. And we want to make it easier, right? Like we started talking actually to HubMD, another organization out of California, and we deploy at the provider level, right? We'll integrate into Athena Health, into Epic. Yeah, you can, now you're going to be able to send AI video to your patients to educate them. We're going to collect assessments. We're going to streamline documentation and care gap closure. But now we're starting to say, hey, we've identified a care gap for this patient and you're an ACO with primary care physicians trying to deal with musculoskeletal issues. We're going to off-ramp you to HubMD where they've got more specialists involved that we can hook you up with. And that's where I see some of the opportunity actually is what companies like Proterra Health are doing is delivering services. And then, Revel AI is a wrapper around your services to make it easier to win in value-based care and to improve outcomes and contain costs. And we're doing that for health systems. But I actually think that what you guys are doing is pretty smart.
No, I appreciate that. And, I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. Kind of, you mentioned that you guys raised a seed round, and I will say that I have had a lot of VC conversations, as you have, and there's two camps of venture capitalists. There's one that see the value of a clinician founder, and there's ones that don't.
Yeah.
And I've been told a lot of things, and they said, you've got to be full-time because if you're in the OR, you can't be, worried about saving somebody's life. And somebody's meniscus surgery is not somebody's life, thankfully. But you can't do that and worry about a company. And my pushback is, well, how do you think we got this far? right? Totally. If I wasn't a clinician, how do you think we're developing our products, our innovation, our language, our understanding the use cases? Like, how do you discount that? And I don't know what your experience is, and or you know what your experience either at the department level on your AI IT work, your Margolis work, or your clinical work. But I'm sure that's shaped a lot of what you're doing and probably responsible for the success you're going to have.
And you know, I agree with you. There are these two camps. There's those that think that we're going to get replaced probably as clinicians, and that the work that we're doing is a distraction from building the technology. And then there are those that I think, you know, rightfully so, see it as a moat. And I kind of think that, especially after the UGM meeting with Epic, the folks in the latter camp were right. And yes, I'm biased because I'm a clinician founder, but how are you really going to differentiate as the technology gets easier and easier to commoditize and to implement? You're going to have deep domain expertise in these different workflows. The workflow is the moat, and there's been nothing that's more powerful for me as a technologist now and an entrepreneur to help develop the product and to accelerate the speed to trust with my clients than my background as a clinician and the impact that I'm making on my patients every single day. So I'm hoping that there's a new breed of founder like us that will become more prevalent, and hopefully a new breed of VC too that
Yeah, I
sees
mean,
the value.
if you look at like I did a lot of entrepreneurial work when I was at MIT as a student, and back then, you know, and the same statistics, 95% of startups fail. Well, that's the same likelihood of you're a physician or non-physician. You're gonna have like that success, and I think the VCs. I think again, I'm biased as well, but I think the moat that you're talking about, if you want to anticipate the next step, right, that proverbial where the puck is going, you would never have thought about the CMS team model,
That's
quality
right.
measures, CMS PRO reporting. If you weren't in that space and seeing it, we were
Years
preaching
ago,
that, right?
for
And
years.
we've been threatening that PROMs are going to be required for several years. There was a talk I gave back in, I don't know, 2017, 18 at the department. Guess what? They came true because we knew it, because we're in that space. We're part of those meetings. So I think that's what there's a lot of. There's a lot of bad physician operators and physician leaders. There's a lot of bad regular non-clinical, you know, operation leaders. It doesn't really matter. At least, again, I'm biased. Of
No,
course, I'm biased.
I'm with you. Like, you know, and you know, that's a great saying, right? Go where the puck is going, not where it is. It's kind of hard to do that if you're not playing hockey.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
you
Yeah,
know, like in
I don't know
healthcare,
anything about the rules, so
in healthcare, being a clinician is playing hockey, right? For health tech.
it
So I
helps,
don't know.
especially if you're deep in it. So you know, obviously, a lot of excitement ahead. You brought up some of the potential collaboration. I already wrote down some notes as you were talking about some of the ideas I have in my head as we kind of bridge the delivery side with the AI side, just to help make it's like it's scaling quality more affordably, right? That's what it comes down to. If we could hire hundreds of caseworkers and case managers, then we wouldn't have a problem. It's not a big deal. We just keep calling until they get done. But when you know, look back. And I know you and I were fairly contemporaries, so we hopefully have a long way to go. But when you look back on the career and train to date, you know, what are you most proud of, and what gets you most excited about the next steps?
I mean, to date right now, I do think that what we're building at Revel AI Health, it has the potential to become category defining from the perspective of how clinical care can get scaled and how technology can be leveraged to improve outcomes, contain costs, and make care more equitable and accessible. I think that that is something that I'm hoping to be really proud of. I'm already proud of, but I'm really excited about seeing it scale. I am really excited about the work we're doing at Duke. I think that we're taking a really unique approach to innovation and population health as an orthopedic department. We didn't get a chance to go over it today, but we have been participating in longitudinal bundles for knee arthritis, hip arthritis, shoulder arthritis. We've started to dive into spine health, bone health. We're looking at periprosthetic joint infection as a potential risk-bearing model of care. I think that Duke's willingness to take the next step and go where the puck is going from a population health perspective is incredible, and I'm just really happy to be a part of it and to lead some of that work.
Well, I am super excited to see how things go. We got a lot to talk about offline, and hopefully this was interesting to everybody and a little bit of tangents, but I think we stayed on course. So, nice
Absolutely.
talking to you, and I will see you at our committee meeting in 2 hours.
I will, absolutely. Hey, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. And yeah, I'm looking forward to building the future of healthcare with you.